Welcome to Cairo Nights. News boss Frank Shires is here, as is chairman of the board, Shane Peterson. I am Mike Lewis. We've got not only a pretty newsy show tonight, we've got a couple of nice asides that are not necessarily as conventional as you might think. That's for later in the show. You got to keep listening if you want to know what it is. Right now, let's take care of some news. New York's attorney general said she's moving forward with an investigation into sexual harassment allegations against Andrew Cuomo. Let me pause that for a minute. If you haven't been listening to the news about Andrew Cuomo, there's a whole bunch of people, well, three people now who have worked for him who are stepping forward with sexual harassment claims. I'll get into that in a minute and what CBS News correspondent has to say about it. But I was looking at Twitter earlier, and I thought that this was a really, really smart take on Andrew Cuomo. This is from a guy named Spencer Ackerman. He says, Andrew Cuomo is to the coronavirus what Rudy Giuliani was to 9/11. In a crisis, his authoritarian tendencies get reconned as leadership. In other words, they work as leadership, and the destructive impacts on people are forgotten. When it comes time for the next phase of his ambition, there'll be bewilderment regarding his behavior. And this is, I think, a super intelligent point. Remember, Rudy Giuliani was one of those people, and probably Andrew Cuomo was a little bit like this as well, who got better the farther you were away from him. In other words, he was more popular during 9/11 outside of New York than he was initially in the immediate aftermath. In the few months after, he was really the fact that the guy was seemed like a really like authoritarian stand up guy made him very, very popular. But, you know, in the time after that, it got increasingly clear that he was a person almost genetically predisposed to not listen to other people or good advisors around him. And this is bringing us back to Andrew Cuomo. I thought that was really because Andrew Cuomo initially was so highly praised at the beginning of the coronavirus for his immediate embrace of the science and immediate decisions to close things down, that there were a group of Democrats, prominent Democrats, who wanted to swap out Joe Biden for Andrew Cuomo as sort of the presumptive party favorite. That didn't happen, I think, probably for pretty good reasons. But it goes to show you that sometimes these tendencies, which are very good in very narrow circumstances, are not as good in other circumstances. And so CBS News correspondent Jerrica Duncan reports that we are hearing more details about the allegations against Governor
Charlotte Bennett, the second woman to accuse New York Governor Andrew Cuomo of sexual harassment, said in a statement that the governor has refused to acknowledge or take responsibility for his predatory behavior. The 25-year-old former executive assistant to the governor claimed Cuomo asked if she was romantically involved, whether she was monogamous in her relationships, and if she had ever had sex with older men.
Maybe the less on the appropriate side as far as questions go in most workplaces. I would certainly hope all of them. So this also now we have another person who has stepped forward, Anna Rook. She had never met Governor Cuomo. This is from The New York Times. Before encountering him at a crowded New York wedding reception in 2019, her first impression was positive. She said the governor was absolutely working the room, toasting the newlyweds. And when he came upon her, who was 33 at the time, she thanked him for his kind words about her friends. But what happened next unsettled her. This is according to The New York Times. Mr. Cuomo put his hand on her bare lower back and said, as she said in an interview on Monday, when she removed his hand with her own, the governor remarked that she seemed aggressive and placed his hands on her cheeks. He asked if he could kiss her loudly enough for a friend standing nearby to hear. She was bewildered by the entreaty, she said, and she pulled away as the governor drew closer. And she said she was shocked and embarrassed. And this is the sort of handsy stuff that he is getting accused of, although it must be said that the president was accused of, although not necessarily sexual harassment, certainly of handsiness. I think there was one aide who did, but it seemed like that was not considered terribly credible because even the Republicans dropped her as sort of a sounding box on this thing. And so now we've got sort of Andrew Cuomo in a slow, graceful meltdown over all of this. It looks like a guy who may have been one of the people at least pulled into the administration at some point, either this one or the next one, it provided a Democrat wins, that is looking less and less likely all of the time. And we will keep covering this as it moves through. But once again, a guy who grew up in a different era didn't manage to recalibrate as eras around him changed and understand the appropriate behavior of today was not the necessarily the it may not have been welcome behavior before. In fact, it certainly wasn't welcome behavior before. But you're governor. It's 2019. You should at least be moving toward getting rid of it. And it makes you think about how many of these things don't actually get brought up, because you do it at great personal cost. I think the people who say this stuff, people think, oh, they're trying to get famous. Or they're like, no, I actually don't believe that. I don't think that there's the only upside is to try and prevent it from happening to anyone else. Because if you have ever had any blowback on social media about anything you've posted, imagine how it feels to be these folks once they decide to accuse a guy who's popular. It was anyway popular in the Democratic Party. It's difficult. And so, you know, my hope is that Cuomo, one, ceases his behavior, but two, maybe learns a lesson from all of this. Now, this is also another pretty interesting story. It's an interesting story locally, and it's going to be a very interesting story nationally. If you are living and working at the Amazon Fulfillment Center in Kent, pay attention. So President Biden issued a video statement on Sunday. If you missed this, you're going to want to hear it, pointing out that the National Labor Relations Act was established not just to enable but to encourage collective bargaining. This is Jim Krasula from CBS News with more.
Although he did not name Amazon in the video, President Joe Biden did refer to workers considering unionizing a company warehouse near Birmingham, Alabama, calling it, quote, vitally important.
There should be no intimidation, no coercion, no threats, no anti-union propaganda.
Reports have described Amazon using anti-union tactics, worker intimidation, and propaganda. The mail-in union vote runs until March 29th. Jim Krasula, CBS News.
So what we're having here, and this is just now, this is happening in Bessemer, which was a Bessemer, Alabama. And this is a former site of unionized steel workers. And so there's actually quite a bit of steel manufactured in Alabama at one particular point. And most of those plants were unionized, if not all of them. And so there is that is one of those towns in the South that actually has a strong union bent because it has a strong history in that regard. This is not something that makes Amazon particularly happy, because Amazon has aggressively been fighting unions since it started getting mentioned. They've done a pretty easy time with the white collar unions because they pay reasonably well. They do ask a lot of their people, but it's just never and the people in the white collar unions, I think, didn't tend to come from as strong a union sensibility as folks who are at the bottom, farther down on the scale, which is really where unionizing kind of got where its roots actually exist. And in this particular case, this has been something that Amazon is going to, if it hasn't already, is going to confront in virtually all of its fulfillment centers. Those centers are pretty tough work. Amazon has improved, I think, over time, as it's gotten a lot of attention about people peeing in jars because they don't have time to take a break. I mean, the early reports on them were pretty savage about Amazon and its unwillingness to provide, you know, reasonable working conditions for people who are, because Amazon is committed to getting you a package, you know, a box of Post-it notes in 24 hours, a whole bunch of people are going to have to pay a price for that. And that is the way Amazon gets all of us, right? That convenience. If you get on Amazon, you order something and it's like 2 weeks, you're what? Well, remember, on the other end of that are people trying to work. And in this particular case in Bessemer, they are trying to actually organize so they get actual consistent and fair labor practices. Now, Alabama, if you're not aware, is like Washington State. It's a right to work state. So you can't actually require someone to be in a union to have that job. However, so it's not actually, and Amazon actually doesn't care to disclose that when it's putting up its anti-union information there, that you can actually opt out and still get the benefits of you're not going to get a different contract because you're not in the union. You're going to get the same contract. And in fact, people all over who are not in unions benefit greatly from the unions. Remember their old bumper sticker with the people, you know, unions, the people who brought you the weekend. This is the type of situation that Amazon is going to pay a lot of attention to. I mean, if it results in unionization, well, I mean, great for the unions. I was a union member when I was a newspaper reporter. My mom worked for three different unions as a secretary. So my bent is toward union. I get people who feel like, who aren't as pro-union, because I do understand how it can, unions when they get overly powerful, like any organization when it gets overly powerful, like a corporation, definitely can start doing things that are a means to an end to achieve more power rather than for its workers. However, I would say that in this particular case, we're talking about some workers, and honestly, I wish it happened to every single meatpacking plant in the United States. We're talking about some workers who are not necessarily always getting those things. And I would say that if even the threat of a union gets Amazon to do all kinds of stuff, which I think it has, certainly the $15 an hour and a few other things, you know, from regular breaks and whatnot, if that does it, then fine. It doesn't, for as far as I'm concerned, doesn't need to be a union. But the, having that sort of having that stick out there along with the carrot, I think is a pretty important thing. And so we'll see where this goes down there. But Amazon has been on full court press to make sure that people don't join a union. It really doesn't want that to happen, because it knows that if you can like pry that little bit of opening up in Bessemer, you can do it in Kent, and you can do it in Reno, and you can do it in all kinds of places where Amazon has these fulfillment centers. And trust me, they're going to have more of them, and they don't want this to be a national trend. That is absolutely certain. All right, last thing we have here is the status that we are in right now with the coronavirus is an interesting one. We have pretty low, low nationally infection rates in King County that we're finding out about right now. And that is, it's excellent news. We have that happening in a variety of places now in Washington State. You have seen, if you have gone out and had, you know, a dinner or a glass of wine somewhere, you've noticed that more restaurants are open, at least on limited hours, with limited sales up until 11 o'clock. Still keeping people distance, a lot of outdoor dining, that sort of thing. But it's starting to feel a little bit more like it's a little lighter now. So it's starting to feel like maybe we're turning a corner. This has actually become a huge concern about from health officials all across the country, that they say the first day of March, this is according to the New York Times, day of March brought a new wave of reopenings and liftings of pandemic restrictions, signs that more Americans are tentatively emerging from months of isolation, even if not everyone agrees the time is ripe. And there are plenty of reasons for optimism. One, vaccinations have increased significantly in recent weeks. We just got another one online with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The daily reports of new coronavirus cases have fallen across the country from the January peaks. I mean, we had that surge, which was horrific, and we are at 500,000 deaths, but it feels like things are starting to turn. In Kentucky, the New York Times points out, all but a handful of school districts are now offering in-person classes. While the state races to vaccinate teachers as quickly as possible, the governor there told reporters that the state's falling COVID infection statistics showed that immunizations were beginning to make an impact. He says, it means that vaccinations work. We're already seeing it. We're seeing it in these numbers. It's a really positive sign. And of course, then everyone's favorite little rain cloud, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said, all right, folks, let's cool our jets a little bit. He said, it's okay for small groups of people who have all been fully vaccinated. There's a low risk of those folks getting together at home. Activities beyond that, he said, would depend on the data modeling and good clinical common sense. He added that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention would soon have guidance for what vaccinated people could do safely. And then there's a whole series of caveats. For example, the United States is still reporting more than 65,000 new cases each day. All right, so that's a problem. And the country is still averaging more than 2,000 deaths each day. Huge problem. The deaths are a lagging indicator because it can take weeks for patients to die. So the daily death rate may be dropping right now, and we're not uncertain about that. And remember, back last year this time, if we were saying 2,000 people a day were dying, we would have been in more of a freak-out mode than we were. And in fact, if we knew that that was going to happen, although a lot of the projections have proven to be fairly accurate, the only projection that actually proved to be inaccurate was the length of time to get to a viable vaccine. That is going to be, trust me on this one, there's probably four different movies and documentaries being planned on this right now. I think that the development of the vaccine is going to be the story of the next couple of years. I think it's going to be kind of a remarkable hero story for the people who managed to put that thing together to get it not only manufactured, to get it distributed. And I know that we have a long way to go there, but it is from where we were feeling in May. It seems like things are good, but again, if you want to listen to Anthony Fauci, and I tend to, we are still we're still not out of the tunnel yet. That light you see is not, I hope, a train headed toward us, but maybe our way out. Coming up, we've got Rachel Bell right around the corner. And at the, well, we've got, you know, not only that, then at the top of the hour, we've got an additional whole run of stuff, including a little bit of a surprise. So we'll talk about that right after the break.
Oh, Monday morning couldn't guarantee that Monday evening you would still be here with me. Monday, Monday, can't trust that day. Monday, Monday, sometimes it just turns out that way.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. On the heels of Black History Month, Rachel Bell had gone out to do a story that celebrates Black History Month here in Seattle.
A few weeks ago, Monica Matthews was able to open a second location of Queen Care in Seattle's Central District, selling her all-natural body oils, scrubs, and creams.
If it wasn't for Vulcan, we would not be able to be in this location here. Vulcan, along with a lot of African-American community members, actually advocated that these spaces be dedicated to Black businesses. Vulcan took it a step further to actually subsidize some of the rent so that Black microbusinesses could actually afford to be in a beautiful location like this. Where we stand right now, there used to be a plethora of Black businesses. It saddens me that they're not here anymore.
Vulcan is a company started by the late Paul Allen. But Queen Care is a whole lot more than shea butter creams and sugar scrubs.
Queen Care was founded actually to support our nonprofit work through the Life Enrichment Group. We started a nonprofit 19 years ago to really help our youth academically, to provide positive mentorship for them, and to help them with economic development opportunities. And so Young Queens of Seattle King County is one of our longest running programs. It's a leadership personal development for young ladies where we focus on self-love, personal development, academic achievement.
The Young Queens program grew into Youth in Business to help young Black women start their own businesses.
They receive in the first half of the program a $600 stipend to help them with logos, collateral materials, inventory, and business plans. We also host pop-up shops for them. And the second half of the program is more of them delving deeper into how to market, how to retain customers, and the professionalism of running a business. And then from there, they fly. And we're always available to, you know, help them even outside of the year-long business development program.
19-year-old Alexia Johnson started with Young Queens in 2015.
Now I have Lexi's Customs, where I do customized resin art. Youth and Business helped me learn the marketing skills that I needed and helped me get the inventory that I needed, like the molds. And it just put me in a group of other girls that want the same thing that I do, is want to start their own business, want to be entrepreneurs, and want to be successful in life.
Life Enrichment Group also facilitates tours of historically Black colleges. And Alexia got to visit many schools back east.
On the tour, we got like accepted on spot. And so it just gave me that experience of, oh, I can do this and I want to do this.
93% of the young women who take this college tour end up going to college. Monica now also offers 5 paid internships every year at Queens Care. The young women learn how to make the products, they work in the shop, and they learn about marketing and business plans.
I think the most fulfilling thing is that all of our young ladies pretty much have become very altruistic young ladies, you know, working in social service fields, working in fields where they give back. And I think that that is kind of the basis of why we're doing this, because it really is about community development. And I really am dedicated to making sure that the African-American presence grows in the Central District. So we just want to welcome everyone to come on back, to come and to add to the vibrancy of this neighborhood.
Go to mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell to find out more about Queen Care and the Young Queens program. Okay, so I'm curious about what you think about this. I think that it is obviously great that she got to open this store in a historically Black neighborhood, but there's something that just rubs me the wrong way about the fact that all of these Black businesses were pushed out because of gentrification and high rents. And then a white owned company, you know, knocked a bunch of buildings down, rebuilt new ones, and then invited this Black business back, which was great, and, you know, gave them a discount or whatever. But there's something that just rubs me the wrong way about that. Not saying it's Vulcan's fault, because they did a good thing. But like, I just don't like, I'm not fully on board with this idea of like, you had to leave and then we're going to let you come back on our terms. It felt a little icky to me.
I actually think that's a very good point, and it struck me the same way. I'm happy that they're doing it. The Vulcan is doing it, and they, I guess, deserve some praise for that. But Vulcan has also been the agent of change in a lot of neighborhoods in Seattle where it wasn't maybe so kind about letting the existing business owners, successful businesses that got pushed out simply because the new thing that came in was way more expensive per square foot, and they just couldn't make it pencil out. You know, the city talks a lot about legacy businesses, and I don't think there's a neighborhood that's been more affected by that than either the Central District or the Rainier Valley, and legacy businesses that were not wealthy businesses. And the city has done almost nothing other than creating this like toothless registry to protect those things. And I think it speaks to just not just Black owned businesses, but a variety of small businesses in Seattle. And in particular, it's an acute problem in the Rainier District and in Rainier Valley and in the Central District, because, I mean, it just literally remapped an entire neighborhood.
Yeah. And in this case, this is a teeny tiny business. So they took this whole kind of corner, and I'm actually not sure what was there before, but you could tell there were a lot of businesses that would have taken up that space. And they built like this huge behemoth apartment building and office building kind of thing. And so the space that they let them rent is really tiny. It's so, so small. So it's not like they're, you know, giving Black businesses a discount on the entire block. It's like this one little space out of the whole corner. So yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm glad that it's happening, and you know, Monica is appreciative to Vulcan, but it's just a weird situation that we live in.
Yeah, I think the city needs to, I mean, this is a difficult thing, right? It's difficult to sort of legislate away someone's property rights. On the other hand, it is, if you want to preserve, I mean, here's my theory, if you want to hear it. My theory is that where we should actually zone is not based on blocks, but based on height. We should preserve the first floor. in neighborhoods where we want to. The first floor is generally where most businesses exist. If you draw the line on first floor and say you can build above it, but you have to preserve that thing on the first floor, we save virtually every business that people have complained about in Seattle getting taken away. We've saved them from the Sunset Bowl to this business to a lot of the businesses in the Rainier Valley. And I think then we actually have an idea that provides a high measure of property rights, but also that street level stuff that really makes a neighborhood. We work on that.
I think that's a great idea because it kind of just reminds me of, you know, apartment buildings having to have a certain number of Section 8 housing. Like there's a certain amount of affordable housing that the government says you have to have in the city. And so it's kind of the same thing in a way. And I think a lot of privileged white people would complain, you know, oh, it's not fair if you kind of broke this down by race and said, you know, if you're in a neighborhood that is heavy on people of color, you know, they get to keep their businesses there. But that kind of goes hand in hand with this idea of reparations. You know, like we don't have a program for reparations yet, or maybe we never will in this country. The idea of, you know, giving money back to people who weren't allowed to make that money because they were slaves or Native Americans who had their land taken away. And maybe that's a form of reparations that we can do, you know, instead of like stone cold cash. The idea is you get to continue paying that same rent. It's not going to go up by thousands of dollars. That's the reparations that you get.
Absolutely. I mean, we can figure out something that can that we can both allow a neighborhood to change and grow, get denser if we need to, but also retain its original character. I mean, that's all, you know, anyone really is arguing about when they talk about these things. And I think if you do that, if you keep that area, that strata affordable, you can get diversity at that point. At least you can get at least make a step toward it. Certainly when you, because of many of the diversity issues are also access to finance and cash. I think that you could actually go a long way that way.
And I just do want to speak to the program, the Young Queens and all of the programs that Monica is doing. This woman is amazing. Like every time she would finish a sentence, I would just stare at her and I would tell her, you are an amazing woman. I mean, she started this nonprofit herself 19 years ago, and it's grown into this, you know, big project where she does the Young Queens program actually in Seattle Public Schools. She partnered with them, and it's actually a class that they get a grade in that her and her people teach because she wanted, you know, education to be a part of it. But like, she's really making she's putting so much effort into making sure that these women, you know, you hear about this in other countries all the time. Like if you're going to send the Peace Corps over, like don't just fix up the land for them, like let these people learn to do it themselves. And
right.
That's what she's doing with these young women, is teaching them how to be entrepreneurs so that they can stay in their neighborhoods, so that they can create more Black-owned businesses. And it's really amazing. I mean, when I heard that when they go on these college tours, that some of the colleges accept the students on the spot without them even applying. I mean, I just was blown away by that. So I think that she's someone, you know, I was talking the other day with a friend about when you talk about Black heroes or heroes of different communities, you only know a few, you know, it's like Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, but someone like Monica, she is a Martin Luther King. She is a Rosa Parks. And so that's why I wanted to do this story, because there's things, you know, there's a lot of people in the city who know about this program, but there's way more people who don't. And I just wanted to shine a light on somebody who is actually doing so much good in the community, like on a really direct level.
Right. No, absolutely. I think, no, it's a great story. And thank you for bringing it to us, Rachel.
You are so welcome.
More to come on Cairo Nights. Stay tuned. So, welcome back to Cairo Night. But so, the continued arresting of people involved in the Capitol riots is not necessarily, the Capitol riots, there's nothing about that that was either amusing or funny. But the manner in which people are getting caught is getting more and more interesting. Now, a lot of these people, they essentially caught themselves. They are the people who posted their own pictures celebrating on social media, selfies, trackable phones, you know, histories of social media posts, all of it. And you wonder to yourself, like, at what point did you think that this was not going to come back and bite you? And I got news for any of you who are worried about that sort of stuff that you post on social media. Yeah, even after you delete it, it can still be recovered. Now, if you're just deleting it because you don't want friends to see it and you're not really under arrest for anything, I would go ahead and use the delete all you want. But understand that it is recoverable all the time. And anything you post there can linger for a long time if someone knows what to look for. Well, there's a pretty great story in BuzzFeed today about the way people are getting caught who were involved in the insurrection. The from FBI agents who went to high school with certain people, and they're like, hey, and then they go back and look, and sure enough, the same person I went to high school with, and like tracked him down through an alumni association, the person who was told, I think, by undercover folks that they were eligible for a vaccine was caught. This is a good one. The several people have been turned in by exes who recognized them from photos that were posted on social media. Some have been recognized by coworkers who posted after they posted those photos on social media. Family members, neighbors, clients. This is kind of astounding. It's astounding that people who went out there, I mean, when I am out in a public area, let's say I'm walking past a federal court, my assumption is that I am on camera. If I am in a courtyard in an area, I figure I'm on camera. If I'm in Washington, D.C., I know I'm on camera almost all the time. And this modern cameras, not only can they get highly, highly detailed photos, you know, facial recognition software makes everyone's game a lot easier. And I understand that there are communities that don't want it around. Portland is one of them. San Francisco, Seattle has restrictions. And I get it. And I actually kind of agree with it. But in this particular case, you went to a place that is the Capitol. So the Capitol in D.C. is always going to have that from a security standpoint, which is something that we all know pretty well, except for, I guess, a few thousand people who showed up there and the few hundred who actually rioted inside the Capitol itself. And it begs this big question. Like, did you think that what you were doing was legal? Going into the Capitol in that manner at that time. And I actually think that there's a whole bunch of people who did. This is the weird thing about all of this. I do definitely blame the people who went in the Capitol and tore stuff up and, you know, made death threats and scared a bunch of lawmakers. I mean, it may seem casual to you. And if they had run into lawmakers, would they have done anything? And I think that's a fair question. But the fact is, if the threat goes out there, then the crime goes out there. And I would also argue, though, that I still feel like more aggrieved about the people who fanned the flames and then sat back. The people who went out there with bullhorns, the politicians who actually encouraged people to feel like the country was actually being overrun or taken from them, or they're being defrauded out of a fair election. I don't think that everybody who went in there was doing this as a cynical act. I think that some of them believed, come lock, stock, and barrel, everything that they had been fed through social media. And I feel like in that case, the people who said the stuff to them, maybe we should take a harder look at them than some of the people who went inside. But, you know, whatever. The people who said stuff, we know who they are. And we have an easy time identifying them. And I guess we're going to find out if any of that stuff can be held liable. Certainly it can't with the president, as we've already witnessed in an impeachment trial. But I would say this, like if you're planning some sort of event like this, maybe it's a good idea it'd be a better idea to not do anything illegal at all, but maybe just recognize, and I think people will now, and maybe this is the great danger. Now they're going to recognize how easily people can be swooped up and caught, how silly posting stuff on social media is. And I guess the only concern I have at this point is, well, driving people underground does not make us any safer. It just makes them more obscure. And so maybe this is the last great hurrah of people actually being dumb enough to put that stuff out there. I suspect it's not. There's no shortage of idiots. But it would be nice to see, in some way, the people who actually ginned up all of that hate maybe bear some of the weight of all of this law enforcement that's going on right now. Coming up in the next hour, we have a whole run of news stories we want to get through. And then, of course, at the bottom of the hour, one of my favorite subjects, kind of big developments in Tesla land and in other electric-powered vehicle land. We'll have all of that news right after the break.